This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Saturday Science. I'm here to introduce Stefano Forli. Professor Stefano Forli, actually. He is my boss and my mentor, and the reason why I came to Scripps in the first place. Stefano is from Italy, and where he studied pharmaceutical chemistry and obtained his PhD in computational chemistry. He will explain later what that means. And after that, in 2008, he moved to San Diego to work in the Olson Lab here at Scripps. And since then, he never left Scripps. In fact, he built here his own lab in 2015. I am from Italy too, but I met Stefano here in San Diego 4 years ago for the first time because he gave me the opportunity to work here at Scripps for 3 months during my PhD. Imagine what this means for a PhD student from Italy to come here to San Diego for 3 months. I was the happiest person in the world, and I will always cherish that. And I am leaving it again and again because after 4 years, I came back to work here as a postdoc. This is how much I enjoyed it. So, and I have to say that I was not the only one who had the chance to come here. But every year, Stefan and Art Olson give the opportunity to various students from all over the world to work here in such an inspiring and creative context. Working in our lab is something quite unique because we live in a very diverse environment. There is the chemist, the biologist, the mathematician, the physicist, the computer scientist. All of these expertises are combined to create something quite special. I'm so happy that today you have the chance to listen to Stefano's talk. I wish I had this chance when I was your age. So maybe I wouldn't have been so scared about pursuing a career in science. Because if the environment where you work is safe and if you're surrounded by persons that are here there to help you and to cooperate with you, you would not be scared anymore. And this is what Stefano Forli was able to create during these years. So enjoy his talk. Here is Stefano.
Thank you for coming here. Well, thank you, Julia, for the very nice introduction, I have to say. So what we're trying to do today is to give you an idea about how you can use computers to pursue science, in particular, how you can use computers to find drugs. So now everybody now is used to the presence of computers, but it wasn't always the case. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of the history, how we got where we got, and all the funny parts related to that. So, you know what is a computer because you've seen them around everywhere. So the definition of a computer is an electronic device that you can use to store data, process data, and so on. But it wasn't always the case. So initially, computers were mechanical, and you can actually see that there is in the red box there is a crank. So the first computer in 1800 was basically fully mechanical. So there was a crank, and you could use it to process numbers and to do operations. Eventually, computers like 100 years later were way more powerful, and they were used for stuff way more serious than just crunching numbers because in 1940, that computer called the bomb, designed by Alan Turing, was used to break the secret code of Nazis during the World War II, which was called Enigma. So they also made a movie out of that. So even though computers were getting more and more powerful, more and more interesting, there wasn't much enthusiasm at the beginning in particular. So the director of the IBM around that time in which computers were used to do such an important task, thought that all over the world there was interest for no more than 5 computers. And he was selling computers. Actually, the once computers started to get used in universities, one of those computers was the ENIAC, was a computer that was built in a university. And so this magazine at the time hypothesized that eventually, you know, now computers weigh 30 tons, but eventually they might weigh like just 1.5 tons, so they may become smaller and smaller. And we know that this was actually very true. So still, we go ahead in years, and still computers have a hard time to pick up interest in people. And there was this famous, computer scientist he founded a company that was selling computers again. And then he said, well, there is no reason why somebody would want a computer in their home, right? And that was 1977, which is a little bit ironic because if you look on Wikipedia, 1977 is the date in which it's considered that the home computing era started. So since then, computers became more ubiquitous. Everybody started using them, also for commercial activities, and of course, in science. So many scientific applications started to be used using computers to accelerate that. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So now we know what is a computer. What is a computational chemist? As Giulia said, we're both Italian, so I grew up in Italy. I was exposed to drugs, which is not what you think. It's just that my father was a pharmacist, so I knew drugs. I've seen a lot of drugs around, and I kind of knew what a drug looked like. And I really, really liked computers. So what I liked about computers was the fact that they were able to process numbers, to create new and exciting data, and to benefit the whole humanity, right? Just kidding. I like video games like everybody else. And this was my favorite one by far. So I really like computers. So when I had the chance, when I decided to go to university, I tried to take that into account in my decision. So at the university, you have many, many choices when you go to college. I decided to go to this small university, which is in Siena, which is in Tuscany, a region of Italy. And out of all the possible choices, the one that I liked the most was computer engineering. I wanted to design computers. I wanted to tinker with computers. But then I talked with a guy that was working as a computer engineer in a university, and he told me, well, it's not what you think it is. Actually, as a computer engineer, what you're going to do is to design very small computer-like things, like small boards for weather measurements and stuff like that. And I was like, that's not the stuff that I want to do. So I had to find another way. Again, I've been exposed to drugs, right? So I decided to go toward medicinal chemistry in the faculty of pharmacy, and I started to study how drugs work and how you can make them in the lab physically by synthesizing them. And then at some point, I had to decide what to do for my master. So what was very cool at the time was biotechnology, the DNA stuff. Everybody wanted to work on DNA because DNA is cool, actually. But then I looked at the stuff that they were doing, and I didn't think it was exactly my thing. So for just because of like luck, at some point I met a professor that was doing. I gave up on biotechnology. I met a professor that was doing computational chemistry, and I couldn't believe how lucky I was because that was the best of both worlds. I like studying drugs and I like computers, so I thought, well, that's maybe the best of both worlds. I can definitely pursue that. So, just one step back to give you an idea about my whole trajectory. So. This was my first computer. So my first computer was a Commodore 64 that was very popular in the 80s, and it was hopping like 64 kilobytes of RAM. To give you an idea, this picture is more than 64 kilobytes, just the picture. The resolution was 300 by 200 pixels, which is a little bit bigger than an icon on your cell phone. It had 16 colors, but more importantly, this was a portable computer. Only 24 pounds, right? That was incredible. And it wasn't very portable, actually. And that's why probably because in the ad that was running at the time, when they told this guy, you know, this is a portable computer, and he was like, are you nuts? But actually, that was thinking ahead because, of course, you want to think ahead. So this, of course, was not what I was using for doing my research. When I went to the university, I had a computer that was way more powerful. It was way more expensive, and it was 500,000 times faster than the computer I had at home as a kid. But more than that, in just a few years, there were computers that were more and more fast. And I'm wondering if you can imagine what that computer might look like. I'll let you think about it. And this was the computer that's now 10 million times faster than the computer when I was using as a kid. So one may wonder, people started doing modeling with computers in the 70s. So are we discovering drugs 10 million times faster than we were doing before? And the answer is absolutely no. The reason for that is complex, and I'll tell you more about it. So on the graph on the left, you can see that the computational power on a logarithmic scale increases over the years. So this means that every step in which the graph goes higher, computers become 10 times faster. And this is how we got from that computer that I had when I was a kid to computers that were 10 million times faster. On the opposite side, the graph on the right is telling you how many drugs were approved for humans per billion dollars invested in research. And you can see that the graph is going down. So there are a little bit of bumps here and there. That bump on the right-hand side is when FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, tried to make easier to approve drugs. So they remove the fees, and they throw a lot of money in HIV research. We'll talk a little bit more about that. There was a little bump, but overall, it's going down. The star over there is telling you when computers were used or started to be used actively for research. And you can see that it made pretty much no difference. So the question is, do we really need computers to discover new drugs? Well, I would say yes, but first of all, what is a drug anyway, right? You probably have an idea about what a drug is, but I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. So a drug is a molecule. We consider a drug any molecule that has an effect on a therapeutic target. A therapeutic target may be anything that's relevant for a particular disease, discomfort, or you name it. So generally, a drug is a relatively small molecule, from tens to thousands of atoms. Usually, it's synthesized in a synthetic chemistry lab, and it can be obtained also from natural sources, for example, extracted from plants and so on. The mechanism in which drugs act is by binding, by being attached, interacting with their biological target or a drug target, which is usually a protein, but it can be also DNA. So just to clarify, a therapeutic target is anything, any molecule that is inside our body that can be targeted for a drug. And the way in which it works is usually like this. You have a protein. You have the natural substrate, which is the substance that's in your body that either has to be processed or has to activate the protein to which it binds, which binds to the protein and then triggers a biological effect, which might be, for example, headache, because you have an excess of inflammation in your head, and then that triggers a headache. So a drug might work in two main ways. The first way is by competing with the natural substrate. So instead of having the natural substrate binding to your protein and triggering that effect downhill, what happens is that the drug binds there, it has no effect on the biological target in a sense that doesn't trigger the reaction, and so you prevent, for example, headache. An alternative might be that the drug binds in a different region on the target, but it prevents, for example, the target to open like a wedge, if you want, and so the natural substrate would not bind to the target. No matter what's the mechanism of action, the important thing is that you prevent the effect you do not want, or you might trigger, for example, you can actually induce that effect. But in general, that's how drugs work. So a little bit of context. All these proteins, most of the proteins we're interested in, most of the targets are protein. All these proteins come from DNA. So inside the cell, the DNA contains all the information that's necessary to produce these proteins, which is read and then transformed into sequence of amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. We have 21 of them, and with these 21s, we can make all the proteins that form our body. Once they are formed in this very nice thread, they almost instantaneously fold. So they assume a specific three-dimensional structure, a little bit more later about that, which is essential for their function. But what you see here are just models, because inside our body, we don't have a DNA that is red and blue. It doesn't have this kind of letter shape. What DNA might look like is more like this. So what you see here, this is exactly the same DNA, but with spheres representing the atoms. And the size of the sphere is proportional to the size of the atoms. And the color is a common color scheme because at that scale, we don't have colors. Everything has no color. So red is oxygen, orange is phosphorus, green is carbon, blue is nitrogen, and so on and so forth. But that's, again, another model. So if you're interested in looking at the bonds between these atoms, you might use a different representation, which is with sticks. And you can see that some of the sticks are thicker and some are thinner because they have two different sticks next to each other. That's to show you that this is a double bond, for example. Even more, you can see that there is a trend in the structure, okay? And you can see that that trend forms a double helix, which is our familiar double helix. So this model is not really that far from reality. It's just different. You can actually simplify this atomic model even further and show that, indeed, there is a double helix there. If you hide the atoms and you just project their average position in space, you get something that looks very close to what we use as a scheme, as a schematic model of the DNA. But it depends on what you want. If you're interested in designing drugs, maybe that information is not sufficient. Maybe you're more interested in the surface that the DNA has to look for places where maybe drugs might bind. So we kind of have an idea about a drug, and we know that we can use models to describe drugs, but what is a model? So this is a model, for example. So this is a model of a plumber of Italian descent that has serious problems with mushrooms. Of course, Italians don't look like that, and mushrooms don't look like that, but it's just a model. A model is a simplified representation of a given system we're interested in that gives us the idea, conveys the information we're interested in. We understand that this is a person. We understand that that's a mushroom, there are bricks, and so on. Now, I'm going to say something that might shock you, but this is the truth. All models are wrong. But that's not the whole truth. The truth is that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. And that's what we're going to go... we're going to look for later. So we know that our drugs are atoms, are made of atoms, are molecules made of atoms. Our targets are molecules made of atoms. So what's an atom? You're probably familiar with this, this representation of atoms in which you have tiny things jumping around. But just to give you an idea about the scale, atoms are very, very tiny. So 1 nanometer is the average radius of an atom, but it doesn't say much because we're not familiar with nanometers. So let's say that we are interested in knowing how many atoms there are in an orange. So we can make an approximation. So if we bring an atom to the size of something we're familiar with, a blueberry, how big would it be an orange? Do you have an idea? Okay. I'll try to surprise you. This is how an orange will look like if an atom will be the size of a blueberry. So clearly there are tons of atoms in any everyday object. So now that we have an idea about the scale, we need to make sure that we have a model that is able to capture the properties of these entities at such a small scale. So the most precise representation of an atom is the one described by the quantum chemistry. So in quantum chemistry, atoms have a nucleus, which contains protons, and then a bunch of electrons that shield this nucleus from the outside. And the description of this, this model is extremely accurate. We can predict a lot of properties out of this model. The only problem is that it's extremely complex to calculate. So if we want to use modern supercomputers to use this model, we can actually deal with very, very small molecules, which is not the case when we're dealing with drugs, because we know that the proteins might be very big, and even drugs can have thousands of atoms. So what we do is we use a simplified model. So this simplified model is actually a very simple representation. It's a sphere that has way less properties than the quantum model, but is much easier to calculate. So an atom then will be described as a sphere in space. It will be defined by its position in space and its radius. So we have different atoms with different radii. and different properties associated with them. And then even bonds that in quantum chemistry are described as clouds of electrons, probabilities of clouds of electrons overlapping with each other, are described here as simple springs. So there is a force that keeps them together, and whenever you try to move them, there is a resistance from this bond. So atoms form molecules. How molecules interact with each other? Well, we have a bunch of rules that describe how this model acts when we have molecules in them. And these rules, we call them the force field. So these rules describe what happens in our molecular world, which is not very far from what we've seen before. So when two atoms get too close to each other, the energy becomes very bad, and molecules are not happy. In a similar way, we can describe much more complex behaviors when molecules interact with each other, when they twist and bend. And so we have what we represent as energy potentials there that describe how the energy varies depending on the position and the rotation of the atoms, which is not very far from what happens in a video game, in which the position, the energy, the score associated with that particular moment of the game depends on the position, the rotation of the character, and so on. So what we do inside our own world of molecules is a set of rules that we use to calculate a score, exactly the way in which we do for video games. So there is an energy score associated, for example, with the formation of what's called a hydrogen bond. A hydrogen bond is an interaction that, for example, happens between water molecules, and is the one that confers water molecules that properties of being fluid, that forms ice when you lower the temperature. Another force you might be familiar with is the electrostatic force. Opposite charges attract, same charges repel each other. And so on and so forth. We have more and more detailed forces representations. For example, if there are molecules that are flat, of a particular kind of flat molecules, they tend to attract with each other. And you can see that we tend to represent that with nice colors because they give us a cue of what's happening there, what's favorable and what's unfavorable. Another thing might be very common is the basic interaction between two molecules, which is called the Van der Waals force, which essentially describes how two molecules can get together and lower the energy of the system. So now that we have a model and we have a bunch of energies, we can actually simulate what happens to molecules when they interact. So you might guess the next question, why simulations? So the definition of a simulation is an approximate imitation of a given process. This is a scientific presentation, so there is no scientific presentation without a picture of Einstein, right? So Einstein said a lot of smart things. This is one of them, which I think is very, very smart, very clever, that you do not understand something until you can explain it to your grandma. Now, if you can explain that to a computer, it's even more interesting because you might end up in knowing even more than you knew before. And you might be wondering, but if we put information in the computer and the computer knows as much as we know, how comes that we can get something new out of it even though we put that information inside the computer? I'll give you an example, a practical example. So when I was at the university, I was studying all the known drugs at the time, and many of them were antibiotics. One of them is penicillin. This is the structure of penicillin, so it's a lot of conventions. It might look a little bit complicated, but it's just the important thing is that you get is that little lines are bonds between atoms. Atoms are colored differently. I mentioned you about the color scheme of the atoms. And then that ring, that circle there, it's to say that particular ring is one of those flat rings that when it gets together to another flat ring, lowers the energy of the system. So I sketched that. I put it in a computer and I thought, well, let's see how this molecule looks like. I mean, I'm studying this for the last 3 years now. I should know better. And so this is what came out. I'll try to run the animation. There you go. So this is how this molecule looks like in 3D. And I thought, well, I must have done something wrong. I mean, this molecule looks like a banana. That's not what I was expecting. So I went back, I sketched it again, I tried, I generated the 3D structure, and that's what came out. Then I started looking a little bit more in detail. So I knew that ring was supposed to be, that hexagon there, was supposed to be flat. And it was actually flat in the structure. I knew that, for example, oxygen in those particular conditions when there are two bonds tend to be flat. and it's flat in that model as well. I knew that nitrogen might have been a little bit more out of the plane. It was forming like a kinked structure, and there it was. So it turns out that this model was telling me a lot of things which I may have known already, but I didn't have a clear picture. I didn't have a clear view of what this molecule looked like. So this molecule is the sum of all the information I had, which I put in the computer. Well, I didn't write the program, but I knew what was going to be in there. And yet, I learned something new. So the computer was actually telling me something that I didn't know before. So what do we want to do simulations for designing new drugs then? Well, we can try different different approaches. For example, we can design molecules, different molecules, and try to see which one fits our target, our protein, better. We can try to identify unknown interactions. So we might expect that it binds somewhere, and then it turns out that it's binding somewhere else because the computer is able to calculating the score and give us the best score for what is yet another video game, if you want. So the solution is something that we might not expect. We might look for what are called emerging properties. So emerging properties are these properties that come out of very simple systems when you put a bunch of simple rules, and then all of a sudden you see a behavior of the system which is not expected, which is not simply the sum of all the parts that you put in. So essentially what you do with a simulation is to test hypotheses and ideas. So what does it mean? Well, this means that you are making questions. You are asking questions. So another interesting quote. The painter Picasso said a long time ago, again, when computers were not that well appreciated probably, that computers are useless because they can only give answers. And this is still true. Actually, computers only give you answers. So simulations are extremely well suited for answering questions. But that means that it's our job to think about the question, because if you don't think about the question, the simulation is not going to get you anything interesting. So what is the question we're trying to answer? Well, it seems pretty simple to begin with. So the question is, what is a molecule that is able to bind to our target, our protein, and give us the function we're looking for? So our target is a protein. We are looking for something that binds to the target, but we need to take into account the fact that proteins tend to come in cells. In living organisms, you don't have usually proteins flowing around in general. You might have some in your blood, but overall, you have a structure. And so you need to make sure that the molecule you're trying to design is not toxic, for example. It doesn't have unusual elements like uranium. So you might laugh about that, but there are compounds you can purchase that contain uranium for experiments. You don't want molecules that are reactive, because if they are reactive, they have they might trigger a chemical reaction in your organism and cause toxicity. Many poisons are actually reactive molecules. You don't want something that is under-functionalized or over-functionalized. In other words, if your molecule is too small and doesn't have enough hooks to attach to your protein, it will attach everywhere. The same is true if you have a molecule which is overly complicated, it can attach everywhere, and again, it becomes toxic. The other thing might not sound too obvious to you is the fact that that molecule has to be soluble. Why is that? Because it has to be reasonably soluble. This means that it has to be soluble in water. Why? Because we are formed, we're constituted by water for 70%, 75% of our body weight, so there's a lot of water in our bodies. But all the cells have membranes, and these membranes are greasy. So if you want a molecule that is able to go in your body and have a function, it has to respect those rules, which is adsorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion, which means that a molecule has to be soluble to go in your bloodstream, to be distributed in your body, to be able to pass the membrane of the cells, has its own, exploit its own function, and then be excreted. You don't want a drug, you don't want a pill that you take one day and then it stays in your body for 5 years. You want something that works for an hour, two, three, your headache is gone, then it can be excreted, processed by your organism, and then excreted. So we know that proteins don't look like circles. We know that proteins have a very specific structure, so we can use that information to find molecules that bind to that specific structure with enough complementarity to be specific and selective and give the function we want. So for doing that, we do dockings, which is called docking. A docking is a simulation that we do, which is essentially a simulation between two molecules interacting. We put those two molecules in the program. We make sure that our force field, so the rules of our world, are sufficient to describe that system, and then we look for the answer. So what do we need to do a docking? That's pretty simple. So we need the structure of the target, which needs to be, which can be created by the computer. We are getting good enough at predicting the structure of molecules with the computer, but usually these structures come from experimental data. So there are people that throw X-rays at molecules, and they're able to find their shape very nicely. And you can see that here, I choose a specific representation of the protein out of all the possible ones. Remember, atoms are just those spheres in our world. Those spheres floating in space connected with a given radius. But here I'm showing the surface because I'm more interested in how the combination of all these spheres looks like in order to find a place where our potential ligand to this target might bind. So, of course, we need the structure of our ligand, which in this case I represented with spheres because it's sufficient enough to give me the idea about the shape of this molecule with respect to the protein. And I would say that these two structures are relatively in scale. So this is one protein of your body, one specific protein, which is the one that is called tubulin, and it's the one that is responsible of driving the separation of the two cells when two cells divide in your organism during the replication. And so you can see how a drug is usually much, much smaller than the target. So now we have these two pieces together. Do we have the rules to calculate the score for these two molecules when they get together? Yes, I show you already that we have a bunch of rules. Actually, we have way more than these, because the more you have, the more accurate is your estimate, the quality of your simulation. So now we can predict how this molecule binds to this target. Now, quick quiz. Where do you think this molecule is binding? So I'll try to help you. The upper half of the protein. How many vote for the upper half of the protein? Okay. How many for the lower half of the protein? So this molecule is not binding. Well, you see that there are a lot of pockets, right? So one would imagine, well, I know how the two molecules look like. Can I throw that molecule here and there? What do you think about this pocket here? How many vote for this pocket here? You don't believe in this molecule much, huh? What about this pocket here, which is much bigger? Okay, this pocket seems to be winning. What about this one? Much bigger, right? And you can see that the shape of this molecule fits perfectly here. It feels like they are made for each other, right? Wrong. Of course. But that's because we were looking at this not with the right eyes, probably, which a computer is not, it's not fooled by appearance. So if you look at this molecule, how it looks like, and you look at the shape of this cavity here, which we wouldn't have paid enough attention to, you can see how perfectly matched those two molecules are, okay? Which is pretty surprising if you think about the fact that this, as I said, is a protein that is in your body, and it's acting right now, helping dividing cells during the replication, when we grow, when we replace tissues. And this one is a natural molecule which is found in the bark of a plant. So this is one of the most powerful anti-cancer drugs that we know of, and it's called paclitaxel. So why this molecule, which comes from the bark of a tree, is such a powerful anti-cancer agent? Well, that's because of the shape. If we know the shape of this molecule, we can predict, we can find out that a molecule might bind to a given protein with very high specificity, and we can understand how they interact with each other. So we actually do that in the lab quite often, because our lab is involved in the design of this particular program for docking, which is called AutoDock, which happens to be the most used software in the world for doing this. And one of the reasons for that is because, of course, it's very accurate, but also because it's free. So many people in the world are using our software, and we improve that. We get the feedback from them. So in our lab, what we do is we apply the program to specific biological problems, like might be HIV, the search for drugs for curing HIV, as well as developing new methods. Like it might be, for example, getting better models for that score that I mentioned you, in which we try to predict how waters might interact with molecules, because waters are very important for anything that happens inside our body. So again, we develop our own software, we write the code, and we use it for specific problems, but we try to improve it over and over. So now we have this tool, we have a program that can do calculations for us at very high speed. So what can we do with it? So we can look for molecules like paclitaxel before that might bind to the target we're interested in to produce new drugs. So just to clarify, all drugs are ligands. So a ligand is a small molecule that binds and has a biological activity. But not all the ligands are drugs. And that's because they might not bind strong enough. They might not bind where we want to. So we need to search for specific molecules, which is non-trivial, that are able to give us the function we're looking for. Where do we look for them? So the most common source for these molecules is the repository, the collection of all the molecules that are commercially available. And we have about 30 million of them. Actually, the estimates are a little more toward the higher numbers. Somebody says 50 million, somebody says hundreds of millions. But in general, we have that's the ballpark of the molecules we can access to. So what we can do is to use dockings to go through all these molecules and look for potential drugs. So essentially, what we're looking for is the proverbial the needle in the haystack. So that's a harsh truth. Maybe these collections don't have a drug for our target. How is that possible? But when we have 30 million compounds and none of them might bind to our target, well, that's very likely possible. So you might ask, so where are the drugs? Where are they hiding? Well, it turns out that these drugs are hiding in a much, much bigger haystack, which is the chemical space. So the chemical space, as it is defined, is the space that contains all the possible molecules that can be synthesized using only the simple elements commonly used in organic chemistry, which are carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, oxygen, and so on. So on average, every pharmaceutical company has few million compounds in their stock. So they keep them, they're proprietary. Nobody can access them except the company itself. And they can actually run tests on these compounds looking for their own drugs. But that's not much, because the collection of all the molecules that are commercially available, that means that we can purchase, is one or two orders of magnitude larger. We can actually use computer to generate more and more compounds knowing the rules that form these molecules. But from there on, we cannot actually run the tests, because we're talking about huge number of molecules. We cannot actually perform lab tests, like physical tests, but we can definitely run virtual screenings. But this is just the tip of the iceberg, because the entire chemical space is estimated to be 10 to the 60, which means 10 followed by 60 zeros, which is a big, big number. Just to give you an idea, is larger than the numbers of atoms in the universe, which is big. It's massive. So we're kind of lost, right? So where are we going to, how are we possibly going to look for all these combinations, looking for the molecule we're interested in? Well, we may try to take some shortcuts. One of the shortcuts is, like, we might have an idea about how the needle looks like. So we know that a lot of drugs have been discovered over the years, so we know that their size is contained within a specific range. So it doesn't have to be too small, because otherwise it will bind everywhere. It doesn't have to be too big, because otherwise it will stick everywhere. It has to have certain kind of properties, so the number of hydrogen bonds. We have an idea about the score we're looking for. Similar thing happens with solubility. And then the other thing is that it has to be easy to synthesize. So that's important, because we don't want to look for a molecule. We don't want to, even in silico, we don't want to test, simulate a molecule that doesn't really make sense because it cannot be synthesized. Just to give you an example. So In a computer, you can sketch any molecule you want. You can do whatever you want. And the computer will trust you because the computer says, okay, you give me this molecule, I'll make this molecule for you. I mean, this is a silly molecule. If you go to a chemist and you say, can you synthesize this molecule? You'll probably break a friendship if he's your friend. But the computer will trust you and will say, yes, sure, I'll make this structure. This is the structure of this molecule. It's very ugly, very twisty, but it's very unlikely to be a drug. So you need to be extremely careful. One of the mantras in computer science in general, but in drug design is even more so, is garbage in, garbage out. So if you don't pay attention to the stuff you put in your computer, what comes out of your computer is garbage. So you do everything right. You run your simulation with the proper molecules. You try to make sure that the chemistry is reasonable. You try to be as precise as possible with your simulation. And yet, the only way you can be right is to take these molecules, purchase them, have them tested in a lab, and get the results. And this very likely might turn to bad results. Computers don't lie, but they can definitely be wrong. So just to give you a ballpark, when we do an experiment, our success rate in predicting molecules that are actually active is in the range of 2 to 10%. So this means that we run our simulation, we identify 100 molecules that we think are active, but then we test them and we get 2 molecules that are active, or 10 if we're really lucky. Okay. Why is that? Well, because the computer, again, they don't lie, but they can be wrong. They can be wrong for 2 main reasons. There are 2 ways your model can be wrong. False negative. You have the answer right in front of your eyes, but you don't see it. Why? Because, well, your way of calculating the score is not accurate enough. The opposite, and this is called a false negative. So this molecule is active, but you don't think it's active. Of course, the opposite is the false positive. So you buy a molecule that you think is active, but is not. So this can happen. Of course it can happen. The real question is why this happens. So you can be wrong for many reasons. So for example, your target might be extremely flexible. So it is true that proteins have very well-defined structures, but these structures are not always rigid. They tend to jiggle around, and they might have parts that move, they open and close, and we know that proteins can open and close, right? Actually, it's one of the mechanisms we try to exploit to design drugs. So the thing is to have a calculation that is fast enough to test millions of compounds in the computer, we assume that the target is rigid. So if we know that the target is flexible, we need to tell the computer that, which makes the calculation much longer, but probably more accurate. So unless we need to do that, we tend not to. And that might be a source of a problem. It might be that the structure of the ligand is wrong. So maybe your friend managed to sneak the sticky guy in your library, and then you have all the library of compounds there, of all molecules that don't really make sense. So maybe the structure of your ligand is not correct for that particular target. Sometimes you think that that's your target, but in reality, inside the cells, you have thousands of proteins. The molecule you need to target, your biological target, is not that one. But why? What's the main reason why we are wrong when we are wrong? You should know that by now, because I started the talk explaining you that we are simplifying our representation. That's the reason why we are wrong, because we're using models. So we know that all the models are wrong by definition. Some of them are useful when they work, and some of them are not. So you might think, okay, that's a pretty grim scenario. So we are never going to find something useful. And if we're lucky, we might find it with a very low success rate. Well, there are a lot of successful stories, actually. I'll tell you a little bit more. Actually, recent estimates suggest that the molecules, the computers, are more effective at finding drugs than actually taking your compounds, hundreds of them, thousands of them, millions of them, screening them and look for active drugs. Well, one of the reasons why this happens is because computers are excellent at dealing with complexity, because they are very good at simplifying things or do very complex things in a short amount of time. And let's go back to that success rate I mentioned to you before. So we have a success rate in general in a virtual screening between 2 and 10. 10%. So you might think that's pretty low, right? Well, let's look back. We have 30 million commercially available compounds, just a rough estimate. Let's say that every compound costs about, on average, $50, okay? You want to test all of them. How much do you have to pay? $1.5 billion. If you have $1.5 billion in your target, you can find that molecule that you're interested in. And we found how expensive it is to design a drug. So if you burn $1.5 billion just to look for one molecule that you need to work on to make it a drug, you're never going to make it. But if you try to use the same approach by using docking, say that you do your screening of 30 million compounds. You identify your top 100 hits, $50 each. You spend $5,000, and you might get five hits in a conservative estimate between 2 and 10%. I mean, that's a pretty good bargain, right? So you don't spend too much, and you have a chance of getting five hits. Of course, if you screen the whole set of compounds, you might find way more than five hits, but at which cost? So just to give you proof that what I'm saying is true, during the 90s, there was a big effort trying to look for drugs for the cure of HIV because the awareness was rising, so people were more interested in looking for drugs. And so thanks to this effort, many structures of the viral proteins were solved. Thanks to these structures, many, many compounds were tested, and lots of drugs have been approved just because of that. And in this big effort, computers played a huge role. And you can actually see that there is a dent in the mortality due to the fact that many, many drugs were approved over a very short period of time. And the reason for that is because computers were good. So on a little bit smaller scale, we did something similar in our lab. We're actually working actively on HIV, both me and Art. And we were asked by our collaborators to look for molecules that were derived from a molecule that had a potential antiviral activity against HIV. So we knew that the virus mutates a lot. And so we know that the virus is mutating against those particular regions because when you have a molecule that fits in there, if the protein mutates and it closes that pocket, this molecule doesn't fit there anymore. So we needed to find ways to overcome this viral resistance. So what we did, very simply, was to teach more chemistry to the computer. We taught the computer how to create molecules like this in silico. So the computer was generating molecules from us. And then we fed it the whole catalog of commercial reactives that you could use to synthesize molecules. Essentially, the computer synthesized 16 million molecules for us, which is a pretty good haystack for needles. And it turns out that we found very interesting compounds. We found five particular needles that have been actually synthesized and tested. So we hope that at least one of them will show some kind of activity better than the original molecule in terms of resistance, and then we can get the potential new drug. So every time we do these kind of things, we need to access a lot of computing power. And the way we do that is usually by purchasing huge computers. Our institute, the Scripps Research Institute, has a lot of computing power, but computing power is never sufficient. It's never enough because of all the problems that I mentioned to you, the chemical space, the fact that we have many targets. So there is one great initiative that we joined with IBM, which is called World Community Grid. So in the World Community Grid, essentially IBM provides free computing power to everybody that wants to do scientific research for many purposes that are beneficial for humanity. And they provide free computing power for running our own calculations. So there are many people that are using Otterock in this World Community Grid, which runs on computers that are provided by volunteers. So at your place, at home, you download a screensaver. Every time you don't use the computer, the screensaver kicks in and it starts showing you molecules, the rotating space. These molecules are actually our molecules that are being tested very likely against HIV targets. And so far, it generated 20 billion complexes between ligand and targets, and we're evaluating that. It generated so many results that we needed to go back to the drawing board and think about how to analyze these results because we never had so many results before that. Now, what's interesting, it's a minor bit about this detail, is that the volunteer computers, in quotes, are cell phones as well. So you can actually run that on your cell phone. And so it's kind of a whole circle. So now we have computers that are 10 million times faster than the computers that I had when I was a kid. We're actually using it for doing research. So, of course, it works only when you plug it to your chargers. It doesn't drain your battery for looking for new drugs. But it's a huge amount of computing power that we can actually access for free. Volunteers that give us their spare computing time, and we can use it to a better good. So, in summary, you might know by now that computers made a difference. So they changed the way in which we live, for sure, but definitely the way in which we do science. Mostly because we can make science faster and cheaper. So what are the requirements for our scientific simulation? So summarizing everything I told you, well, the basic thing is that, well, you need sufficient computing power. If you don't have enough computing power, your calculation might be as interesting and as nice as you want, but it will run forever. You need a good model. Having a good model is essential because otherwise you are not simulating anything interesting or anything useful. Garbage in, garbage out. But the most important thing for running a simulation is curiosity. So you have to make a question that is important to answer. So the computer is going to give you an answer. Computers are stupid, remember? They only give you answers. So it's your job, our job, to find questions that that computers can provide an answer for. So with that, I just want to wrap up, and I want to thank the organizers, especially Shirley and Art, for giving me the opportunity to talk here. Whitney, that helped. She was very patient with me for arranging this talk. And then the gang that Julia mentioned before, these are all the people that we work with in the lab. They come from all over the world. They're super nice people. And then they make, you know, going to work a pleasure. And of course, I want to thank you for the patience for listening to me to mumble about this for all this time. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.